At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of the discussion of the Ravens' defense against the Browns. Joining me is my friend Jason Smith of Huddle It Up Films. Jason, how you doing?
Hey, Ken. Glad to be back.
Always a pleasure. We talked about a lot of things that first episode, a lot of great discussion, best use of Brandon Stevens, how the Ravens potentially could be realigned in the secondary, maybe in a way that even could look like the 2012 offensive line shuffle that went into the playoffs. You definitely are of the opinion that that's not changing. I don't disagree, really. I think the Ravens have played well enough defensively that it probably couldn't. I just think they might be a better alignment of the current players that they have in the secondary than what they're using right now.
Yeah, we're similar mindset. I think they're happy with where Nate is, and they want to continue him in his role. And I think Kyle has subtly said that he would like to be a safety and is really happy where he is. And for those reasons, I think that and the way the defense has been playing, I think they're going to go with what got him here.
That's probably the biggest thing, is just how well this team has played defense the last 7 weeks. Since week 11, they've been terrific. We had some debate over whether the Ravens are a top five team, a top two team in the NFL in terms of where their defense is. The only team I think is better than them right now is Philadelphia. That's the only team where I'd say, yeah, I'd take their defense over the Ravens. Houston has looked better in DVOA and some other metrics. They're kind of small. We talked a little bit about that. And then I want to revisit one topic from that first episode and hope to give that a try, is this coming playoff schedule. I have often felt like the Ravens have been disadvantaged in terms of when they play. But one thing you really hope is you don't get the Monday night game. The Ravens, in fact, are playing the Saturday night game again against the Steelers.
Right. So Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, Saturday. So Saturday is our day. And, you know, we're playing the Steelers, who obviously played on Saturday as well. So no advantage of rest for the Ravens, but still having a normal week has got to feel good for them for once. You know, a 7 day rest period, or however, 6 day rest period, however you put it. And, you know, if the Ravens play well enough to advance, you would imagine their game after that would be on a Saturday, but they're not going to be any shorter of a week. So they've already started the trend of not playing on a short week, which can only be seen as a positive.
Yeah, and I'm in the same place, and they'll go to Buffalo for the second game more than likely. If for some reason Buffalo gets upset by Denver at home, which, just saying it, I don't think there's a lot of probability of that. But if that were to happen, then the Ravens would be at home for that second game against either the Chargers or the Texans. So the Ravens, actually, as a 3 seed, there are limited permutations of what they can go. I've said already that people have a lot of Southwest miles. If you're sitting on 200,000 Southwest miles and you don't immediately sign up for flights to Buffalo and Kansas City for the appropriate weekends, you're missing out on an opportunity. to do that. I know a lot of people who work in the corporate world, they often accumulate a lot of Southwest miles because they're easy to get, or you get a new credit card every couple of years, whatever it might be. You can, the big thing with Southwest is you can take those miles and get a full refund of them if you decline to take that flight. So you may as well, you know, buy that option in advance. It's something Maureen and I always do every year.
There you go, Ken. See, Ken's the expert. Nothing to add over here.
All right. So let's talk about a little bit about the pass rush in this game. We talked a little bit about the pass rush being very passive in this game. I think it was really one of the takeaways from this game that I think was a positive for Oregon, very much specific game planning for the Browns, who have a high quality veteran offensive line, but they really used minimal numbers. They allowed a lot of ample time and space opportunities relative to pressure events in this game. And it was by design. They didn't really use a lot of numbers and scheme. And as you're going to hear in a moment, the Ravens really came through with their coverage unit in terms of shutting down even ample time and space opportunities, which normally go for about 8.5 yards of play.
Yeah, it was a good job. It was very cage rushy at times. And of course they did run their stunts in there. Metabike and Van Noy have that down to a T. I think that those two in particular on that right side of the offensive line really, really have that down to a science. But yeah, Ken, you outlined it perfectly. Not a lot of seasoning to this rush. It was pretty basic.
So let's talk about the opportunity set first. And sometimes that might be the right order, might be the wrong order, but this is the way I like to do it. They give up 15 ample time and space opportunities on just 36 plays that resulted in a pass or sack in this game. That's 42% of the time. And if you follow the show, you know, maybe 28, 29% is about average for the NFL right now. But to give up 42% where there's a 3-second pocket and room to step into your throw, you're asking for disaster. Okay. Normally, those 15 plays with a combination of Bailey Zapp and DTR went for 3.1 yards per play, included one sack. So there was a late sack in that group. That was, I think, Van Noy's sack, and two interceptions. So both the Pierce interception and the Wiggins pick six were on ample time and space opportunities where Bailey Zapp doesn't really have a good explanation for why those throws happen. Just those 15 plays were 81 yards short of standards. Now, let's put that in another number. That is 5.4 yards short per play of expectation.
Yeah, I was just trying to do the numbers on that. 5.4 short of expectation. On 15 plays where the quarterback had time. I think that if this were, you know, week 9 or week 10, whenever we played them the first time, and the level of competition was different and the stakes were different and we respected our opponent more, and, you know, we wouldn't have seen this type of approach as a rush unit. We're given ample time and space, 42%. The quarterback's got way too much time back there. We got to switch it up. But it was just for lack of a better word, a lack of respect for the opponent here, and knowing that they couldn't beat us with the two quarterbacks they had.
Yeah, I don't think they would have done this with Jameis Winston. And I think it would have been exceedingly dangerous to basically give him that much time in the pocket. I mean, the rule on Jameis, he will give you some unforced errors, but he'll give you a lot of forced errors too if you make an effort to get after him and move him around a little bit. And Bailey Zapp, he didn't know how to take advantage of the defense when he had ample time and space. He couldn't position the ball well. There was wind, you know, not arm strength. There's reasons for it, but reasons that made it very difficult for Lamar Jackson to set the all-time passer rating record. That wind was difficult for that. But Bailey Zapp, even more affected by it because just doesn't have a similar arm strength.
Yep, exactly. And then, you know, usually the longer the quarterback, has to throw, the easier it is for his receivers to uncover. You can't cover forever. But and the Browns, you know, Jerry Jeudy and Elijah Moore, I don't think are a bad twosome, of receivers. It hurt them not having a legitimate third option that the Ravens have to worry about. But it's still they underwhelmed offensively. And I think in some ways kind of mailed it in offensively and really didn't challenge. Because a couple of times they challenged the Ravens in the intermediate and hit. And you know, I think there was a whole shot in there, and there was a nice little play to the inside. They really never went back to it. It was like, all right, let's just run the ball a bunch now.
Yeah, they didn't do as much with Akins as they could have, as much damaging. They threw a third and eight ball or whatever it was to him that was 2 yards behind the line of scrimmage and tried to get him to make a play. It's an awful play call. I think it was just you're trying to think against the Baltimore Ravens who are great playing downhill defense, good tackling unit, and you know that's your last chance to get across the goal line on third and whatever it was. It just that didn't make sense. The you mentioned the lack of a third option. And I was going to say, they did have the one good play. I think it was Davis, right? That the guy had the ball stripped it right at the pylon?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I could be wrong about that. Maybe that was another receiver.
I'm remembering there was like a long time where the announcers were complaining that Jerry Jeudy didn't have a catch. I don't think he was highlighted or targeted very much. Looking at the box score now. Yeah, Jeudy ended up with 13 targets, so he definitely got targeted by the end.
Right.
Akins 8 and Elijah Moore 4. And then just from there, it's just Bates with the one target. Wow. Yeah, it was Jamari Thrash actually had targeted, and I think he was the guy that drew the flag on Stevens. It was the one that was overturned, the goal line, wasn't it, on Thrash?
Yes, I think you're right, because it's not Davis. Davis actually doesn't have a target. So I think it was
Thrash. I think it was the rookie Thrash.
It's obviously they're not playing with a complete deck of cards here.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Let's go a little further. Ball out quick, 14 times, 109 yards, 7.8 yards per play. That's actually quite good. 25 yards above the standard on those plays. And you know, that's almost 2 yards a play better than expectation. But then they had 7 pressure events. They only got 18 net yards, 2.6 yards per play. Nothing particularly terrible about that. That's not a big difference maker. What was the big difference maker is Bailey Zappe couldn't do anything with the ample time and space opportunities that he had. That was more than 100% of the underperformance of the opportunity set in general. He underperformed the opportunity set by 62 yards net, which is a very large number, by the way, for a single game. It's in this case was almost 2 yards per throw, less than worse than expectation. And, you know, he should have thrown for about 236 yards. He actually threw for about 174. It wouldn't have made a difference in winning or losing the game, but it would have made a difference on the scoreboard, I'm pretty sure.
Absolutely. Especially early in that game. I thought that they, you know, would be more aggressive and would be able to take advantage of some opportunities while the teams were feeling each other out offensively, defensively. You know, usually you can experiment and find out what you have, what you don't have early in those games.
Or just 7 pass rushes in this game of 5+, 19% of the time. Everything else was pretty much a 4-man rush. 4-man rush was effective. The 5-man rush was effective. All the rushes as numbers were close to the same. Okay, I'll go through this real quickly. They rushed 4, 29 times, 5.0 yards per play. Both of their sacks, both of their turnovers came on those plays. They rushed 5 times, 4.8 yards per play. They rushed 6 once, no yards per play, and rushed 7 once, 5 yards. So basically they were the same whether they rushed 5+ or whether they rushed 4 exactly. And it was just a case of the secondary doing a better job when they were only rushing 4, which I think was defensively I would put as the biggest single story for the Ravens in this game was how they pretty much controlled Zappe without having to rush him.
Yeah, love it, love it. And it's a good sign for this defense. I wouldn't read too much into it. I think it was a function of quarterback play mainly, as you're suggesting. But, you know, it definitely wasn't a bad sign. You know, if anything that was good, we got away without having to show too much. And I suspect it may be a little bit different when it comes to Russell Wilson and trying to pressure him this Saturday. And he's definitely seems like he's taking his share of sacks. We've got to him quite a bit in the 2 games we've played already.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how they change up in terms of what they're doing. The Steelers were relentless in terms of their pass rush on Jackson, particularly in terms of their blitzes, forced the Ravens into a ton of extra eligible receiver blocking in the last game in particular. And I would be surprised if we don't see some similarities to this because I think the Steelers realize there's a value to the run blitz when it's not a pass, when it ends up being some sort of RPO play that they're working out of, but ends up being a run play, there's a lot of value in having additional man in the backfield.
That's a great point. And I would say the other reason I would suspect them doing it, probably one of others that we're not thinking about, is they're a very turnover reliant defense. That's part of what got them to the playoffs, was being number one in turnover differential. And listening to Tomlin's press conferences over the last few weeks, that's something that he always points to, is that, we're not getting the turnovers that we need to do. We need the ball. We want the ball. We got to get the turnovers that disappeared. Maybe said it on Hard Knocks too, but I've seen a lot of Mike Tomlin these last few weeks, Ken, more than usual. But yeah, it's a turnover reliant defense. And to do that, they're going to have to heat up Lamar, who's obviously been very careful with the ball when he's throwing it. Can they get a strip sack? Can they force something out? Can they speed up the clock on some of these receivers and saying, okay, we're going to blitz, so we know Lamar's hot read is here. Can we come up and smack this guy and make him drop it? That kind of thing.
You know, it's interesting that the Steelers Tomlin situation and the Ravens Harbaugh situation are not that much different in some ways. Now, the first one is both teams have had underwhelming playoff success despite being extremely well-run organizations that are traditional winners year after year after year. There are people who claim that the Ravens, really the Steelers more than the Ravens, are trapped in mediocrity, that they never get a decent draft pick because they never are willing to go through the cycle and they're too committed, kind of like Cal Ripken to the streak of non-losing seasons. I don't really believe that's true, because I think the Ravens want that for their season ticket orders as well. And let me tell you, I want that as a season ticket holder. I don't want them giving up on games. I do not want that. I don't want to ever have to go through a tank season where I'm paying for tickets. And if you do want that and you're not a season ticket holder, I don't really respect your opinion on it. That's my personal feeling about it. You don't have the right to call for a tank season when you're spending somebody else's money to do it.
Gotcha. But hey, I see a lot of similarities between the two situations. You have a very vocal portion of the fan base. I would think that they're the minority of the fan base that wants their guy gone. And you have a lot of other fans that realize that the two coaches have faults, but also realize that they've been very, very successful and they like the culture of their team, and know that they have a lot of good points, more good points than bad. I think that if anything, Tomlin gets a little buddy-buddy with his players, lets them get away with a little too much. And I think Harbaugh doesn't let them get away with anything. I think that would be I'm overstating it there, but I think that that's a difference between the two. Harbaugh has had Lamar, and the team has underachieved, at least by media standards and fan standards, for this Ravens team in the postseason. And then you look at Tomlin, he hasn't won a postseason game since 2016. Mm-hmm. And that's, I can only imagine what fans would be saying if we hadn't won a postseason game in, 10 seasons now, or in 9 seasons, I guess. It's still 2024. If Tomlin doesn't win this one, this will be the ninth straight season he hasn't won nine seasons since his last one. Right.
So, yeah, it's honestly, I look at the two situations and I'd say I don't think either team would be right to fire the kind of coaching situation. I think there's just too much downside to what can happen. But I understand it more in the case of Tomlin. And I think in terms of game management, Ravens fans don't appreciate what they have. Right. The way that Harbaugh has embraced analytics, he's so far ahead of Tomlin in that particular area that that's true. And then people want to focus on things like the Diontae Johnson situation as being a significant factor. Well, look, we don't know exactly what happened with Diontae, because the Ravens are extremely well run and they won't say what exactly was wrong. But they did take a huge step to basically say, we're suspending you for not entering the game, and it's going to be a 1-week suspension. And did we probably think it was going to happen? It was going to be a permanent thing at that point? Yeah, I think we probably had a good notion that it might be a permanent thing at that point, because it's a very big step to take. It made him a 3-time loser. His track record, his rap sheet, is as long as your arm in terms of previous violations, 2 now out of 3 with good organizations, the other one with the Carolina Panthers, who were desperate enough that they should have wanted him to stay anyway, but are a much better team now without him. If you saw the Panthers play today and beat a motivated Falcons team in week 18, I mean, that never happens. It just never happens. And they didn't only they didn't just beat them. Even though it was an overtime game, they really took them to the woodshed defensively with Bryce Young at quarterback. You know, it's just, it was funny to see that. And Deontay Johnson had to look at the various places he could be right now. If he hadn't been a problem in all three places, and say, I could be in Pittsburgh and we could be in the playoffs and I could be number two receiver or three receiver, whatever he'd be. I could be in Baltimore. Zay Flowers could be hurt now, and I could be one of the top two options at receiver. He could convince himself of that, I'm sure.
He doesn't care. He's got his money, and that's what it is. He doesn't think like, a lot of other players and people.
Yeah. Oh, well. I'm the Tom Ennis situation is what it is, but I think that Ravens fans ought to really count themselves as being pretty lucky that the situation we have is extremely good. And if you think there's something to be gained from a change of DNA or a layering of DNA, I think that the risk you have is any new head coach you have might unravel what you have in terms of your current set of rules and structure that has helped that DNA to be layered in. But, and I'm specifically talking about, let's look at the Roman and Monken layering of offensive DNA that they've done. I mean, a lot of the Roman scheme is still there. It still was coached the same way. The offensive line coach was basically a set piece until this year. And I think that's very valuable. I would worry that if they brought in a new guy, first of all, he'd want to hire a bunch of his own people. And he's going to have the right to do that under Bisciotti. He's going to have the right to hire his own new coaching staff. And in so doing, he's going to change the nature. He's going to revolutionize what's done. And you're going to lose a lot of the really valuable institutional knowledge that this team has.
Yeah, I don't think it's happening. I think Harbaugh will be coaching here as long as he wants. That's my gut feel on that. I don't think even a one and done this year changes that. Maybe it does, but I kind of feel like he's a made man here.
He's signed through 2025. Which means that this offseason, he'll be extended probably for three more years, because you always get extended before the last year of your deal. And if the Ravens were unwilling to extend him, which I do not believe that's going to happen. If the Ravens were unwilling to extend him and they went to him and they said, hey, look, we'd love for you to be here as a coach of the Baltimore Ravens next year, but we'll offer you an early out. That's the only way I can see him kind of leaving. And I don't really see that happening. I could see it happening prior to the 2028 season, which means he would be extended for 3 years through 2028, but we get to the same kind of tipping point before that year. Maybe it's the end of the Lamar deal. Maybe any number of reasons might be happening that it would be a good time for Harbaugh to decide, hey, I'm okay with us each parting because you don't want to re-sign me kind of thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I could see it. Yeah, the contract. I don't think there's any way they let him go into next season as a lame duck.
Right.
Right.
I'm with you. All right, a little bit of deception. What's going on in this game? They used 8 off-ball blitzes, 0.22 per play. Nothing special about that, and it's also not a large number. One of the interceptions did happen to come on a blitz like that. Stunts, they used 7, one of them a double, so it was really only 6 plays, 5.2 yards per play. Simulated pressures, they did use 6. That's a little more than normal, a little more than they have in recent times. It's also a little surprising because that's usually done to fool the offensive line and mess up their blocking assignments more than it's used to mess up the quarterback. So the offensive line, I think, would not be as likely to fall for it in the case of Cleveland's group. But they tried it a little bit, and both interceptions actually came on simulated pressure situations.
Yeah, I think it's almost like token for us to show simulated pressure on third down. I think it's kind of in our DNA. We're in a mug the A gap, with both linebackers, and it's just kind of the look. And you know, this game we didn't really bring a lot of heat. You said mentioned 8 off ball blitzes. It looks like, sounds about right. Pretty standard, a little below normal.
There wasn't anybody who showed up in the Ravens pass rushers who really had a big game. Oway was the only one of 2 pressure events within 3 seconds. And by the way, that's the difference between my numbers and PFF. You're going to see on PFF, they have late pressures included. You know, so someone goes chasing after a quarterback when he's outside the pocket, that goes as a pressure. Somebody gets a quarterback hit late. I realize the value of that event, but it doesn't get included in my pressure totals, and it would still be on an ATS play that would occur. So just if you're looking for differences in system, that's what you're seeing there. But Owe had a sack minus five, and he had a pressure within 3 seconds. Van Noy had a late S minus four and another pressure, but no other. They only had four other players who even had one pressure in the game. So it wasn't. This was by no means a high pressure game on the quarterback.
No, it was. I'm not too worried. I'm not too worried heading into the season. I think both of those edge rushers in particular have proven themselves to be very capable. So congrats to Kyle Van Noy on his career year, and maybe even a bigger congrats to OA for hitting that 10 sack milestone, which isn't, it's only one sack more than nine sacks, but it looks a lot better. And often think about, not often, but lately I was thinking about how different fans would perceive Owe if he was taken a handful of picks later. Instead of being a first-round pick, the 31st overall, he was a second-round pick. Would fans be so quick to call him a bust? And some of the other stuff that we've heard about Adafi Owe, who I think has progressed about how you would have expected out of the draft if you were even on him. If you weren't high on him or low on him, you would say, look, it's going to take him a while. He's going to, work his butt off. He's going to hustle. And, by year four or so, you're going to see a double-digit sack kind of guy. You could see that. And I think that's pretty much I think he's progressed fine.
Well, let's jump into the individual segment here and talk about some players. And I have some things to add about Owe. I don't know if you have more to talk about from this game about him, if you'd like to talk about him first.
No, I think that's my main thought on Owe. And, I like the fact that we can also move him. We've seen him over right tackle. So we've given Kyle some chances to rush over the left tackle. But between the two guys, you do have different styles. And I think Owe has come a long way with his bend and being able to threaten the edge. And his get off of the snap, I think, has improved. And that was really the missing part that, in my opinion, held him back so much. It wasn't so – if you have the quickness of Adafi Owe and the pure athletic ability to press the pocket like he does – he has a pretty good bull rush, but all that goes out the window if you're late off the ball. If you're late off the ball, these tackles are way too good. They're already set, and you're not threatening anybody with speed. They're already more than ready to anchor on a bull rush. And I think Owe just basically getting off the snap has been a big part of his development.
It's absolutely huge. And I always thought there should be a way to teach that, but I would agree, 100% agree that that's the thing basically from his senior year at Penn State was apparent, was that he just, for an athlete, this is as fast as he is and as powerful as he is. It's like, how the hell can you not be quicker off the snap?
In Pee Wee, they tell you it's the ball. Like, Pee Wee and all the youth coaching I've done, you just watch the ball. The ball moves, you move. You don't move. And it's usually the other way, Ken, so you're not off sides. Don't go by the quarterback. You wait for that ball. You watch the ball. When the ball moves, you move.
Yep.
So it's just like, seeing a pro go through it. It was frustrating over the years for me watching him, and I baffled. Like, what do you see? I don't know. I've got, the 8-year-olds, the 10-year-olds, the 13-year-olds, they can all do it. I don't get it.
So a little bit more about Owe from this game. First of all, big, great set of contributions, run and pass. He had this one stretch of Dorian Thompson-Robinson getting him to the right, which allowed Hamilton to come up and make that, highlight real tackle, but frankly, it was Owe who made that play, stretching him to the edge. He shed Teller as a pulling guard. That is, it's very unusual to see that. Usually, guard lines you up, and he had him lined up pretty much straight, but Owe just shed him in this particular case and made a play, moved inside to make a tackle on the edge. Some of the best edge setting we've seen from Owe this season, I'd say. In fact, he's been taken off the field because he's so important to them as a pass rusher. They don't want to really use him on early downs. They have, Harrison and Robinson to take some of those early downs and be, perfectly serviceable, pretty good edge setters in that particular, but they can't waste the pass rush snaps they need Owe for, on early down run defense. So they haven't really been doing it, but when he's out there and he happens to do it, he can still make some things happen. The thing is about overall pass rush productivity, and I need to hit on this. Last year, in terms of, you can look at the pass rush productivity metric, but pass rush win rate, all kinds of things will show you this. But look at PFF's pass rush productivity, because it's an easily available thing. And you'll see he was up in the, I'll give you the percentile ranking, because I think he was like in the 83rd percentile of edge players last year. 83rd percentile in 2023 in terms of his pass rush productivity. And that includes his pressures and his quarterback hits and sacks. And there is a weighting for the two of those. And I don't remember exactly what it is, but he was in the 83rd percentile of that metric. He dropped to the 62nd percentile in 24. So his overall pressure rate is lower. Okay. And it's been noticeable. I mean, he's just not getting as much pressure this year as he did last. But here's the big thing. His close rate has improved dramatically. So last year, he had a lot of problems with missed sacks. He was the first guy in on a lot of sacks and then couldn't take the quarterback down. He had problems even finishing with quarterback hits. And there probably was some more element of players like Clowney and Matabike just getting there first some of the time. But his rate of finishes on sacks was 26% of his pressures in 2023. It's up to 50% in 24. And that's how you get a 10 sack year, despite what's probably actually a worse overall pressure year.
He looks like he's more patient when as soon as he knows he wins and has a line to the quarterback, he looks mm-hmm. more patient. Like, yeah, you think he had that, like, oh boy, there's the quarterback. I'm going to hair on fire, straight line to him as fast as I can to get this sack, because it's so hard to win. It's so hard to win as a pass rusher. I mean, you get one sack a game, you get 17, you're defensive player of the year conference. So, you know, so hard to win. So when he get those opportunities to win, he would just haul butt to the, you know, to the quarterback. And I think that I've seen him take his time a little bit more, you know, ready for the okie doke, ready to know that the quarterback's going to see him and try to spin out of it or step up around it or do something. So, you know, it took a while, but yeah, definitely a better finisher. Definitely a better finisher. I think that someone else that I would like to talk about, Matabike, I think that his finishing, Ken, is excellent. It's one of the better finishers for a defensive tackle that I've ever seen, being able to manipulate his body and just have a feel for the quarterback. I think sometimes he gets a little bent on finishing and can draw penalties that way, but he definitely likes to.
Saving money now during Menards Bag Sale. All prices after 15% bag sale discount. Pick up a 6-pack of LED light bulbs for just $2.97. Get a wood or fiberglass claw hammer for only $2.29 each. 52-ounce bottles of Ajax dish soap, just $2.97. And 12-packs of Shasta soda in assorted flavors are only $4.19. Don't miss out on Menards Bag Sale happening now. Good through January 12th. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close.
Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Put his body on the quarterback and is able to do so.
I mean, I don't think there's anything to look at this year in Matabike and say his season is far below expectation. He's just got a more normal number of pressures relative to total sacks this year than he did in 23. 23, he had kind of a very narrow and tall pyramid with a lot of sacks. Relative to his pressure total, his pressure is off a little bit. He suffered some during the period of the year when Jones and Pierce were not available, or Jones was in there actually and playing and wasn't any good because he was hurt. But when Jones has been in there to provide doubles, he's basically playing between Van Noy, who he's got some good twist relationships with, you mentioned earlier, and he's playing next to a guy who basically is allowing him a lot of single team opportunities against guards who just can't match him for athleticism. So he's had a little bit of a down year, I think. Four personal fouls. I didn't confirm that what you said in the first episode was true, or was accurate. But I think it was. If it is, it's not a good relationship between sacks and personal fouls, and it's the kind of thing he really needs to get straightened out. But you know, if anybody expected him to be a regular 10 sack per year guy, I think they're kind of just fooling themselves. There's almost no defensive tackle in the whole league that is. So I'm fine with him being a, you know, a 6-7-8 sack guy. If he can do this consistently, if we were to drop to 3 sacks and his pressure rate were to drop way off, first I look at schematically what's gone wrong with the Ravens in terms of the guys playing next to him.
Yeah, I was kind of preaching that all off season. It's like that, you know, you realize Madubuike is not getting close to 13 and a half sacks again, and it's not going to mean he's a worse player this year than he was last year. Yeah. That's just a fluky type number, and you know, I think Ken, philosophically, they've been asking their guys to just kind of bull rush and compress the pocket. I'm not sure if this is an open strategy or, but just something I've noticed, something to keep in mind. I don't know if anybody else has noticed or charted these kind of things, but the amount of times where it's just straight bull rush from three guys, and the guy who's being double teamed, usually Travis Jones, is just like the quarterback, designated quarterback batter of the baller slash a spy to roller outer type thing. It's kind of what I'm seeing. It's like they're going to tell their three out of their four guys to just go straight through the quarter, through the lineman to the quarterback, not let him get out of the pocket. And then the guy who's getting double teamed to just hold ground and keep his eyes on the quarterback instead of trying to beat two guys, get his hands up.
It's very often that guy's, and it's Travis Jones typically, but it's Michael Pierce also last year to start the year. And Michael Pierce on a fair number of early downs this year. The value of that player is so misunderstood by general NFL fans. They look at Travis Jones' sack total and they say, well, that's not very impressive. He's not out, but what the hell is McKusick talking about in terms of him driving the Ravens' pass rush? It's the single teams you get. It's those one-on-one opportunities to win for your other primary pass rushers. And the Ravens have three guys this year who can certifiably win one-on-one in Madubuike, Owe, and Van Noy. So you got to make as much hay as you can with that. You don't need to have, you know, a whole stable of edge rushers. You can stack them to the sky. You can have five on one team potentially, and they wouldn't help you as much as one interior guy, a Haloti Ngata or Pernell McPhee, or now a Travis Jones, who commands those double teams and really is responsible. He's the general of your pass rush.
And we saw this when we faced Philly on the other side. And I think their combination is quite frankly, I take over ours, and I love our guys. I love our guys, but Jalen Carter, I had him ranked ahead of Will Anderson coming out just for what you just said, Ken. Mm-hmm. The value of those inside, you can find pass rushers on the edge, but to find one consistently on the interior is just gold. And when we had to double Jalen Carter and Jordan Davis was on Pat McCary, that was a bad situation for the Ravens offense. We had that part of the reason they gave us so many problems.
Yeah, thank goodness Jordan Davis is not a guy who can play every snap, but Jalen Carter is a guy who played all but one snap against the Ravens.
Freak.
And you know, it basically puts him in the class of Aaron Donald and Cam Hayward and all the best players. And I'm talking Cam Hayward in his prime, you know, that really could play almost every single snap if they asked him to. It's just he's a freak. He's tremendously valuable. And they are the one team. They're the one team defensively I'd put ahead of the Ravens. Right now,
I think you're slighting Minnesota a little bit. I like that defense too. Okay. I was thinking Philly, Minnesota, and then Kansas City. I put us up in there. Houston, you know, whatever your top five would be. I would think those would be the top five teams. But, you know, thinking off the top of my head, that was what I came up with. Like that Philly team though, bro. I think Philly's got a good chance to make it out of there. Detroit keeps finding a way to like surprise us, I think, with these injuries. But who knows when that'll catch up with them.
Please don't tell me about anything about tonight's game. I still haven't watched it. I just
lost track of it.
Okay. So anyway, continue on. Let's talk about another player. Is it my turn to go with somebody?
Yeah. I talked about two guys, I think.
Okay, well, let's talk about, I think we've hit on Owe. I want to talk about Michael Pierce just a little bit, just because it was a fun interception, but Pierce has done a lot of things right for this Ravens team, and he still is a big component of their run defense. To have him healthy again has been a big part of the defense coming back and being as good as it's been. You need to have one of those two guys on the field every single play. Either Pierce or Jones, they almost never play them together. The exception is like a fourth and one play or something like that, but they basically never play those guys together on the field. So it's not like the Brandon Williams and Pierce combination, which was an enormous bludgeon that the 2016 and 17 Ravens would use when Pierce was first coming into the league. This is a pair of players who are now each teamed up with their own special running mates. And in Brandon Jones' case, we do participation by play. And I tell you, one of the first things we do is we put in Travis Jones's snaps, and then we copy that line down for Jones. And there's usually only like one or two plays where we have to make a change in the thing.
So those guys are out there together. Yeah. Right, Meta BK and Jones, and what a player. I think that love Travis Jones, mentioned on the first show. I think it's a priority for us to get a younger guy, a carbon copy of Travis Jones. Those guys will go later. We got Jones himself in the third round, so you don't have to even spend, first or second round pick on a guy who profiles as a run stuffer being his main thing, but you can trust to push the pocket for you.
Yeah.
That you really like his ability to finish, but his ability that you got to put two dudes on him or else he's going to throw somebody in your quarterback's lap.
Yeah. Exactly right. Is
right. Yeah. So I want another young buck. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I want to finish with Pierce a little bit here because this is really important to me. The play where he dropped, and there was a question about this, is maybe you can explain what Pierce is doing when he drops to coverage. Well, what they're trying to do is still have only four rushing the quarterback and provide some credible amount of coverage in the secondary. And if you look at just what Pierce did on that play, and we've seen this from Urban before too, in particular, he's altered throws even when dropping to coverage. You see him alter it always at the line of scrimmage. But Pierce actually dropped to exactly the right spot. He knew exactly what he's doing on the play. He dropped to exactly the depth you'd expect from a lineman to do. Billy Zappi happened to make a terrible throw that was behind the receiver. Pierce closed on that ball like he was a safety, put it away, and the guy has a future of being laughed at in softball someday for not being able to slide, but that knee he took looked incredibly awkward.
Yeah. Yeah, Mike Pierce, you're out there, buddy. Man, don't do that to your knee ever again. Ever again. That scared me. That scared me. I didn't know
injury
you were,
risk.
It was a great play. And it was funny. I had a lot of people look at my Michael Pierce highlights cut ups because I guess there's not a lot of them out there. So mine got a lot of traffic. And somebody said it was from months and months ago. So before this play, somebody had commented he was a linebacker at my high school. So when it was in my notifications, and it was from months ago. So it wasn't just somebody coming in after this place, trying to be hey, he played linebacker in high school. This is hearsay. Months ago, somebody said he was a linebacker in high school. So we got to see a little bit of that on that play, but what a great play. And it obviously got the guys all fired up. It was a great way to end that game.
It's certainly one of the big plays of Michael Pierce's career. You could just see that football would not be a lot of players. They don't care about the balls that they are their big things. Anquan Boldin never kept like big footballs from milestone moments and stuff. He would give them away or not even get them. But he said he just didn't keep any of that stuff. Michael Pierce, he will die with that football in his possession. Nice. I will never leave him. But good for him. And it's also nice to see Nate Wiggins get that first pick. Maybe we talk about him next a little bit in terms of.
Yeah, sorry about that. I lost that we were talking about Pierce. I shouldn't have because that was a huge moment for him. And it was just so enjoyable. Yeah, Nate Wiggins. Ken, I just want to restate what I said in the first episode very quickly in case anybody missed it. I think Nate Wiggins is an excellent off-ball cornerback. The way his eye balance between the receiver and the quarterback is exactly what you want. It's ideal. His forward break, his lateral breaks are excellent. And he is patient with it. He is not worried about you double cutting and running past him because by the time that ball goes 30, 40 yards downfield, he will have caught up to you. So he trusts his speed. Just all the qualities you would want from a guy at that spot. And I think when he gets in press man or bump and run, he can get a little grabby with his back to the ball. So I think he's perfect where he is. I think that he's best suited for where he is right now. And the future is bright. And, of course, the conversation will be next year. Do you want him to travel? Do you want him to play, you know, right cornerback and face off against some of these bigger X receivers? When you face Pickens, do you want him going against, you know, traveling wherever Pickens is going? And that's a conversation for another day. It's really going to be interesting to see how the Ravens fill out their roster, because to me, he's more like of a Marcus Peters or a Samari Roll than he is like a Chris McAllister, big old strong bump and run type guy. So really interested to see how Nate Wiggins' career progresses.
Well, if he's Marcus Peters or Samari Roll, he's either of those guys with a lot more closing and makeup speed. I mean, he's just, those guys were eyeball players. Roll more of a follow guy, but more of a makeup speed guy, but not anything like,
I mean, no, Peter. Wiggins is a different beast with his speed, and they said it just comes off so great that he's not worried about the double moves. He's like, yeah, if you want to go up, go ahead. You want to go downfield, go ahead. I'll be happy to just wait one extra second, turn my back, and I'll see you at the ball. So and you know what? Intangibly too, I love his confidence. For you know, he was one of the younger players to come out of the draft. He came out as a true junior, you know, and he had no problems, you know, talking smack to Nate or to Malik Nabers while they were on the goal line, and he was getting targeted three times in a row. Just awesome, man. I'm a big Nate Wiggins fan. Go ahead, Ken.
My prognostication for Wiggins, basically, I look at a player and he's got two major elements that are holding back his game, and he still has not allowed a touchdown this year. He had an interception. But there are two things that have held him back. Number one is not catching the football when it's in his general vicinity. He's going to get better at that because he couldn't be worse than he was this year, including the pick six even, which was a fine play. He probably missed five or six other interceptions this year where he had between a 20 and 90% chance to collect that football. And, you know, probably should have ended up with three and a half interceptions in terms of expectation. Just from that, that's a lot of marginal gain to pick up. That's fully within developmental expectation. He doesn't need to do anything special to get that. He doesn't need to improve tremendously to get that. He should just get that because he's better. Where he can still improve in getting his head around quicker, getting you know, coming back to the football more. But the second major area for improvement is in learning to be less grabby and truly trust his makeup speed at the NFL level, which we haven't proven yet. He's had too much of not getting his head around and running through the guy fouls, which is more, I associate more with Stevens, but Wiggins has had some too. And the other one being that he's been a little grabby at the top of the stem. And if you're, you know, Nate Wiggins is a guy like Deion Sanders who could literally force that guy to go prove he can beat him. But he hasn't done it this year. I think his penalties, if I had to look at them, I would not feel like he had to make them penalties. Like a lot of corners, they get beat on an island and they better hold because it's otherwise going to be a touchdown.
Exactly.
That's not the case with Nate Wiggins. And I just, the expected growth next year from this player is so much that he could easily jump into the top 5 to 7 cornerbacks in the entire National Football League as early as 2025.
I love it. Cause you've noticed the same thing. It's grabbiness and it's unnecessary grabbiness. And that's why I think that with, you know, when he plays more off coverage, that he's protected from that.
Yeah.
You know, he's in control more instead of just being in trail mode from the start. He can do better at getting his head around. He can do better at, you know, not being as grabby, unnecessarily grabby. And, you know, the interceptions things, I just think, you know, maybe he's got good hands, maybe he doesn't, but on average, he should have called a few more.
All right. We got lots of players we can still talk about. I'd like to talk about Ardarius Washington, but how about we look at the mailbag for a second, then maybe come back to a player or two if we've got time.
Sure. You know, we addressed one earlier, but there was one particular I was looking at. It was the first one from our buddy Connor Kellerstoss. How can the Ravens turn the constant targeting of Stevens into an advantage? Seems like the Ravens do not want to take him off the field. So, you know, hey, the Ravens don't want to take him off the field in this scenario, Ken. Can they turn that into an advantage?
Yeah. If they don't want to take him off the field, then I think the place where he could possibly help the Ravens is if they could come up with some sort of way to get him rotational to free safety, to get him on the back end of cover three, to have him looking downhill at the ball. Now, they've seen him a lot in practice, and they've obviously developed an opinion on whether or not he could be that guy, but I don't think he's really had the opportunity to be that guy very often in the NFL. And I think it's if you have a guy who has a very specific way in which he's consistently getting beaten at a position, I mean, or he's failing in the business world at a very specific way, you try and reposition that player if you otherwise like him into or that employee into a position where his weaknesses are minimized. And I think that you know, the best chance for it to happen in a practical sense is probably moving him to safety. If the best chance to have it in terms of what could happen, I have no idea how they could really minimize if they're not willing to travel, if they're not willing to do the things that would really effectively change the role of Stevens at right corner.
And this also ties into the other mailbag we had. It's the same. It's basically the same topic, Ken. So this one, Lyman's backpack. It feels like opponents' best drives come when they intentionally targeting Stevens. I don't understand why the coaching doesn't adapt, especially with decent cornerback depth. I'm curious to your thoughts. Are they trying to get him right or just blindly loyal? I'll start with this one, Ken, because just build off your thought. I don't think we have decent cornerback depth. I don't think they trust Tre'Davious White as much as us that we do as fans. I will say for this, do you want to build off of that? Because I want to give my strategy for the Steelers game here.
Right. I mean, I would agree. I think that we'll see White in six defensive back alignments. They'll continue to use him there, and they'll probably continue to rotate him for one series per half kind of thing. But I think we're going to continue to see Stevens be the primary right corner.
Okay, so for this particular matchup, I think that they may have a tighter leash on Brandon Stevens than they definitely did in the Browns game. And the reason is this, it's because of George Pickens. Mm-hmm. And we saw Trey White against Pickens play the contested catches as beautifully as you possibly could. I bet you guys remember that in the end zone. Trey White, top of the jump, timed it perfectly, you know, strong with Pickens, had hand on the ball, and Pickens still almost came down with those, Ken. Like, these were amazing skilled plays by both players. Trey White got the best of George Pickens. So, okay, like, if we're matching up with a route runner or something like that, somebody who could really lose Trey White, like, there's a reason that he fell off with the Rams. But it isn't that he – like the skill set that Pickens presents, I think matches up better. Like Trey White matches up better than Pickens. You were going with like a guy who struggles at the catch point with one of the best catch point players in the games George Pickens. So in this game in particular, Ken, it would not surprise me if they had a shorter leash with Brandon Stevens and were like, look, in this matchup of catch point player, where who's our better catch point player? By far, it's Trey White.
Well, it definitely in terms of characteristics to find the football in the air, Trey White is ahead of Stevens at this point in his career. What I'd be concerned about is, particularly against Pickens, is, and I, with all due respect to his success against Pickens in the first matchup, there were some ways in which the football was thrown that positioned White for those throws better than his enormous size disadvantage versus Pickens relative to that Stevens has. Trey White, I have not seen good information on his height. There's a lot of variance in that. What that tells me, and he's probably a player who wants to be listed taller than he really is. But Pro Football Reference lists him at 5'9". And he's definitely shorter than Stevens. I couldn't tell you if the difference is 4 inches or if it's 2.5 inches, but he's definitely shorter than Stevens.
Yeah, I don't think he's 5'9", though. That seems like Ardarius's height. I would say Trey White's probably about 5'11".
Okay, so the Ravens roster lists him at, let's get to this right now, at 5'11", 192. Pro Football Reference lists him at 5'9". And let's see if PFR, I know, has, or PFF has it as well.
I wonder what his combine was, too.
Yeah, that'd be a good place to look. But they have him at 5'11 on PFF as well. So maybe the difference is only 2 inches. It certainly seems like it could be more than that. And it's not like Ardarius Washington, for example, hasn't played much bigger than he is. I'm not a fan. The Ravens have not traditionally been a fan of non-aircraft corner outside carriers. So they really value height and length tremendously there. And he's, regardless of whether he's 5'11, 5'10, or 5'9, and I think we'll agree he's one of those three. He's not 6 feet tall. He's challenged from a length and height perspective.
Yeah, 5'11", 32 and 1/8 arms.
That's actually pretty long for a corner.
So yeah, he's long for his. I noticed. I do think he's a lanky type guy, but yeah, I mean, still, you look at Pickens, like Brandon Stevens' toughest quality to handle is the catch point, versus George Pickens at the catch point is the ultimate mismatch in this in skill sets. You know, and I would trust Trey White, and I think that if Pickens has a good series against Brandon Stevens, that it might be Trey White time, like we saw in that one game where Trey basically took over for Brandon at some point in the game and finished the game there.
Right. All right. Well, maybe that'll happen. Any other mailbag questions that we missed here? I want to make sure we do a good job with this. We did get a question from Dan from Dundalk who asked a question about whether or not the Ravens will draft somebody with a free safety skill set effectively. Do you expect him to bring in another safety cheap to play the deep half nickel? Actually, he asked it better. He asked it, do you expect to bring in someone cheap? Well, there's two ways you can get a cheap player. You get somebody cheap through the draft, you can get somebody cheap in free agency. Dan, I'll say definitely one of those two ways. Where are you on that?
Me too. I kind of... Dan, and shout out to Dundalk. That's my hometown. That's where I am right now. I can't remember the last time the Ravens trusted a rookie safety to start.
Landry?
Right. It's been a
Will
while.
Will Demps? Yeah.
Yeah. So, it just screams to me the kind of position where you would want a veteran in there. So, Dan, I kind of feel like they would double dip in that spot. You have Kyle's contract coming up fairly soon. So I don't think they would, splash free agent sign another free safety. But, Ken and I talked about it in the first part. We're both with you 100%. If you want Kyle to be a do-it-all safety, you've got to pair him with another safety who can do it all and handle the back end and not just be a box safety. So Kyle's not pigeonholed into just trying to handle the entire back end by himself. Which is an overstatement, but you get where I'm coming from, and I know you guys agree with that. So, we're going to have to invest maybe a young safety, in the third round, that we think that can develop into a starter by next year or the year after, year two starter, year three starter, to pair him with a decent patchwork safety signing. That way you got three guys that you can trust, but you don't want to throw the rookie out there blind to start the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think probably draft one, sign one would be the way I'd go. And I think they really need to have four guys they can trust on the back end. And right now, I don't see a good reason to believe that they should trust either Kane or Breed on the back end. Now, one of those two probably survives as a special teams player. Maybe one of them will eventually develop into a guy who can play the back end in the NFL. But I don't think the Ravens really should be putting their chips in that pot. I think they would do better to kind of find a guy in the draft that they really like for the traits they want to play the back end and then sign another guy who fits the bill with NFL experience at the position.
Yep.
All right. Well, we can do one more thing. You want to do MVPs 3-2-1 here or for the defense or.
I didn't have any in mind, Ken. Why don't you go ahead and give it to us if you don't mind.
All right. No, happy to do it. And then maybe if this creates a little more discussion, that's fine. My number three guy, we've already talked about, Adafe Owe, great game, mixed contributions, nice season, in terms of what he's done. But I think there are some reasons to be a little concerned that the pressure rate is off for the year.
Yeah, agreed. We talked a good bit about him. I believe he got a game ball after the game and it was just nice to see because it wasn't just for the sack. It was for the 10 sacks and the adversity that he has overcome. And I think that Adafi has played hurt. I've kind of noticed on tape where his explosiveness comes and goes a little bit, Ken. From game to game, maybe disappear for a couple of games and then, he gets rested up and comes back. But I think that overall in these 4 years, he's played banged up. He's been a tough guy for this team and, overall, very solid player.
Yeah. My number two guy, Darius Washington. A bunch of contributions on run and pass in this game. One of the things I like about seeing him is he's a very sure tackler on the back end. And that's an important part of the safety's job description. You can't afford to be a bad tackler back there. And that really hasn't been a huge problem for him. And he's looked good against bigger men. So We have Akins in this game, who's a big tight end, and you know, outweighs him probably by 75 pounds or close to it. And you know, he's still able to take him down. He's able to also cover a guy like that, and whether he's underneath or he's leaping for the ball over him or whatever, he's actually very competitive at the catch point with bigger men too, which I've been very impressed by.
His technique is excellent with bigger players. I think he knows that he's quicker than them, and he just gets in a great position and is able to, you know, reach around the defender, punch at the ball without drawing interference calls. Very, very impressive. Just, you know, like I've said on this program many times, whenever he comes up, he is a great, great, great football player. It doesn't mean he's a NFL Hall of Famer or anything like that, but to be able to play at his size and do what he does, that means you are great at the game of football. So technically sound, able to bring down bigger players, able to cover bigger players, able to play much faster than what he ran at the combine, which also prevented him from getting drafted. If he would have ran a 4.43, maybe he gets drafted like Antoine Winfield did in the first round or so. But he wasn't afforded that chance. But you would never know it if you just watched him cover ground.
I'm very excited about who he is. My number one guy for this game, Nate Wiggins, kind of a breakout game in a lot of ways. I think it's clearly the best game of his rookie season, and one that I think he'll remember very fondly with the pick six. And he really shut down his targets pretty much the whole day. They had a completion of the tight end that was really tight. It was a very incredibly poor spot, frankly, on the field to give him the first down by a complete yard when it looked like it was razor thin whether or not he'd actually made the line to gain or not. It's like an 8-yard gain on third and seven, and it looked like he stopped him basically right at the line. They gave him a full extra yard. That play I thought was just outstanding in terms of being the player he is, you know, a smaller guy whose main ability is this, you know, elfin long range coverage, to being a guy who can seriously thump and come up and take a guy down and stop him in his tracks.
Yeah, love Nate. Just giving the thumbs down celebration. I like it, Ken.
All right. Outstanding. I think we'll call it there for the night. Jason, such a pleasure to talk football with you for a couple hours anytime we get together. Really appreciate you making time. Tell folks where they can talk football with you.
Sure. At Huddle It Up Films on X, on Twitter, X. And then also Huddle It Up Films YouTube. End of the season, I'll have highlights on all these guys, including the O-linemen, the defensive guys. So that's one of the values of my channel is highlight players that don't usually get highlighted. And then Wednesday night, we do a live show at 9:15. So please tune into that. Would love to hear your comments in the chat, and we bounce off of that. And we're going to be looking hard at this Steelers matchup, even though we've previewed them twice before, Ken. We have to look at who's healthy, take a look at what this Steelers offense is going to try to do to the Ravens and how we can combat that and what we're going to try to do to them and how the weather might play in. So just an exciting week. I'm happy to be with you during it.
Yep. It'll be a big week to see, I think, if Deshaun Elliott is back for that Steelers defense, because I think he's a much underrated key to their secondary. A little bit in terms of coverage and a lot in terms of making up for Patrick Queen's tackling deficiencies.
They love him there too. They love him there.
Yeah. Other folks out there, thanks so much for listening here. Got a lot of content for you this week coming up on the channel. Stay tuned for the offense show, I should say, which will be out tomorrow. We have two MVP shows coming up this week. We have a Know Your Foe on the Steelers game. Look forward to the matchup episodes with Frazier Tafar. We don't know if we're going to be able to squeeze in a one last thing. Of course, we'll have Friday Morning GM as well this week. So full week of content for you. Please look forward. And thanks again. You're listening at the end of a 2-hour show or the second part of a 2-hour show. I know you're one of the really loyal people and I really appreciate what you do for this channel. Jason, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Ken. Goodbye, everybody.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Percent of business leaders say AI is a top priority. But with AI tools popping up everywhere, how do you separate the helpful from the hype? The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at one-third of Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. With over 15 years of experience building responsible, secure AI, Grammarly isn't just another AI communication assistant. It's how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. Designed to fit the needs of business, Grammarly is backed by a user-first privacy policy and industry-leading security credentials. This means you won't have to worry about the safety of your company information. Grammarly also emphasizes responsible AI, so your company can avoid harmful bias. See why 70,000 teams and 30 million people trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise. That's grammarly.com/enterprise. Grammarly, enterprise-ready AI.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate. Which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close.
Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.